Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. A couple of weeks ago, the American College of Physicians issued an updated position paper on firearm safety, recommending that doctors ask their patients about gun ownership and gun safety as a public health measure. A few days later, the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action released its own brief chiding the College of Physicians for overstepping its bounds and, quote, rehashing the same tired gun control policies, unquote. The NRA then sent out a tweet which said in part, quote, someone should tell self-important anti-gun doctors to stay in their lane. That same night, 12 people were murdered in a mass shooting in a bar in Thousand Oaks, California. And this came the week after the murders at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The response to the NRA's tweet was and continues to be vociferous. The stay in your lane phrase spawned a response with its own hashtag and Twitter account called simply, This Is Our Lane, in which thousands of doctors have tweeted back to the NRA and shared stories of gun violence affecting their communities and pictures of themselves spattered with blood as they worked on gunshot victims. One respondent, Dr. Judy Melanick, a forensic pathologist in the Bay Area, asked, Do you have any idea how many bullets I pull out of corpses weekly? This isn't just my lane, it's my effing highway. Dr. Melanick's tweet went viral, as they say, and now she's appeared in newsprint and on television from coast to coast and from Africa to Australia. Dr. Judy Melanick is a forensic pathologist based in the Bay Area, where she's also a research associate at the University of California, Davis, Department of Environmental Toxicology. She's also co-author, along with her husband, T.J. Mitchell, of the memoir, Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Judy Melanick, welcome to Medical Monday. So let's start by having you share with us, what was the tweet that the NRA put out that got so many doctors, including you, a little bit inflamed, and then share with us your response that went pretty viral?
The NRA put out a tweet the other week about self-important doctors staying in their lane with regards to gun violence, that doctors should basically just shut up and dribble, kind of similar to what people had said about basketball players not entering into politics. The problem was it was in response to recommendations, a position paper authored by the American College of Physicians, which instructed doctors to talk to their patients about gun safety to make sure that they have their guns secured, or if they're going through a mental health crisis, to intervene to take away their weapons so that they don't kill themselves. And the recommendations also included comments about activism and speaking out about gun violence in a public forum, and I guess that's what the NRA was responding to. Well, when they tweeted out this admonition, physicians all over the country started responding on Twitter with the hashtag, this is my lane, or this is our lane. And their responses were devastating. There were photographs of emergency room physicians with blood spattered on their scrubs or on their face shields, blood on the floor of the emergency room, and honest descriptions, devastating descriptions that doctors are sharing about talking to family members of those who have died. I had seen it reported on NBC News, and I had initially tweeted it, I think, on Thursday. And then on Friday morning, I woke up to go to work, and there was another gunshot wound case at the coroner's office where I work. It was one of two that I had done that week. Earlier in the week, I'd done a homicide, which had multiple gunshot wounds, and this was a suicide. And I just couldn't be silent anymore. And I tweeted out, do you know how many bullets I pull out of cadavers on a weekly basis? This isn't just my lane. This is my effing highway. And that went viral. I had no idea. I had to actually shut off my phone, went into the morgue, and when I got out, I saw hundreds of thousands of likes and retweets and phone calls from news agencies asking me to speak. So that was really surprising.
And it's really been a worldwide response. I mean, you were on CNN with Christiane Amanpour. You've been in many newspapers, including The Guardian. I think I saw a clip of you on the Australian broadcasting system or in Australia. So in, I think you mentioned also, I mean, really world over, you've had responses or requests for interviews.
It's been overwhelming. And I think part of it is because I'm a forensic pathologist. I see the end point. I see the real consequence of death. You have to understand that as much as my colleagues in the hospital setting see gun violence, they only see about half of the deaths because a good half of those deaths die at home or die on the street. They never even make it to the hospital. So they come to us in the morgue at the coroner or medical examiner's office.
as a medical examiner and a forensic pathologist, you are called upon to determine the cause of death often in a multitude of cases, not just in gun violence. But how prevalent is gun violence in the Bay Area where you primarily work?
It's prevalent in the sense that we see both homicides and suicides. Very few accidents with guns, but mostly it's suicides and homicides. I looked at my own statistics just out of curiosity. I've done over 3,000 autopsies to date. That includes my experiences in New York, San Jose, San Francisco, and now Oakland. And I have done over 300 gun death autopsies. Of about half were homicides and about half were suicides.
And I think the national numbers, I forget, it's tens of thousands of gun-related deaths per year. But what I learned in researching this is that about two-thirds of those are actually suicides, successful suicides.
Yes, I have the statistics from 2015 to 2016. 27,000 were homicides in that time period. 45,000 were suicides. So almost twice as much were suicides than homicides. And suicides are much more easily amenable to intervention because frequently people are already depressed. They've expressed either suicidal ideations or thoughts to loved ones, to doctors or caregivers. So there is an opportunity to intervene, especially if they are gun owners.
Dr. Milanick, it really, I've always had this question, and I think many of us that follow the news at all, you know, certainly know that the NRA is a very strong advocacy coalition for gun rights and gun ownership, and obviously contributes a great deal to politicians, and politicians are often very afraid of going against the NRA or even talking in any way about gun control. But what I guess what frightens me personally as a physician and as a, you know, taxpaying citizen is why the NRA seems to advocate in terms of not allowing research on gun violence. I mean, just shutting down the conversation and essentially providing a chill for allowing our federal agencies or the CDC, for example, to engage in research. I mean, do you have any thoughts about this?
What's interesting is that the NRA was originally a gun safety organization. They were not a gun advocacy organization. They were designed for people to learn about guns and experience shooting and learn how to safely handle their weapons. And at some point, and I think it was primarily as a result of funding coming from the gun manufacturing industry, they lost their vision. I have plenty of friends and colleagues, both physicians and law enforcement officers, who are law-abiding gun owners and who don't want crazy people to get guns. When I ask them about what's going on with the NRA and their advocacy to shut down research or to silence physicians, they roll their eyes and they're appalled, even though they are NRA members themselves. So I think that there is some change happening now as people start to realize what the NRA is funding and what they're doing with their money. I know that they've been losing a lot of membership as a result of this. And I think that it's worth their while, even if they are an advocacy organization for manufacturers, it's worth their while to come to the table and talk to politicians and gun safety advocates such as myself to come up with solutions that can actually benefit them. And the reason I say benefit them is because let's talk about technology. We are using technology that is from the previous century. And yet, as I said in other interviews, my iPhone doesn't work unless it is unlocked with my fingerprint. I can track it anywhere in the city with a GPS. In fact, we lost it the other week, and we followed the cab using the GPS on the iPhone. Why is it that we don't have this level of technology on our guns? This would allow officers to not have to worry about a criminal taking away their gun and using it against them. It would also mean that if a gun is stolen from your home, you could recover it. I know that manufacturers would benefit from regulation that makes them put this kind of technology in guns and replace what's out on the street with this, and they will have plenty of guns to sell, and they will come to the table and see that this benefits them too.
One of the discussions that I've heard involved a kind of a framing of the debate, and certainly this tweet from the NRA that had chided doctors to stay in our lanes, which precipitated this huge response from the medical profession, and I should say physicians of all specialties. You are a forensic pathologist. I'm an internist, and it was the American College of Physicians that issued these new guidelines. But you mentioned to me offline that the American College of Surgeons also came out with a very strong advocacy position stating that surgeons are another specialty who see lots of damage from gun violence, and that, in fact, this is indeed the lane of surgeons. So this is pretty uniform across the medical profession. One of the discussions that I heard, though, talked about, we don't talk about, for example, car control or automobile control. We talk about automobile safety and how physicians really led the way in pushing for seatbelts and airbags, and how we have dramatically reduced the number of fatalities from automobile accidents. Do you agree or have a thought on whether or not, I mean, changing kind of how we frame the debate from gun control to gun safety might make a difference? Or do you think that that's really just semantics?
I don't think it's semantics. I think this is the way to go. We have to talk about the safety aspect because we're not about to change the Second Amendment. And I want to point out that the American College of Physicians and American College of Surgeons recommendations both respected the Second Amendment. They're not talking about repealing that or changing our Constitution. They're talking about putting in common sense gun laws that are substantiated by research and data that allow us to keep guns away from people who are dangerous and allow law-abiding, mentally competent people to own guns. That's the point of the restrictions. And I want to be able to point out that it's not only surgeons and internists and forensic pathologists that are impacted by gun violence. I can't think of a specialty of medicine that isn't impacted. There were radiologists tweeting. There were anesthesiologists tweeting. Even plastic surgeons who have to revise and reconstruct people's faces after a gunshot wound to the face were commenting. So you've got people coming out. I've even gotten emails from chiropractic specialists, rehab doctors, and nurses who care for patients as a result of gun violence. This impacts all specialties, and it also impacts all people. Guns don't care whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, a Libertarian, or you don't engage in politics at all. It affects all of us, so we should be able to come together across partisan lines to come up with a solution.
One other specialty that is probably worth mentioning is just emergency medicine, because so many emergency room doctors are, I think, the first point of contact with physicians when people are unfortunately shot by, whether by intentionally or by errant bullets. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Judy Milenik, who is a forensic pathologist based in the Bay Area, where she is also a research associate at the University of California, Davis, in their Department of Environmental Toxicology. She's also the co-author with her husband, T.J. Mitchell, of the book Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. Dr. Milenik, you're also the CEO of Pathology Expert Incorporated, which I think is really a company you started to use your expertise as a forensic pathologist. I'm gathering that people consult you really all over the country or even all over the world where you work on cases and offer expert opinions. Is that a huge part of your work?
It's a significant part of my practice because when you're a forensic pathologist, you become trained during the fellowship program to testify in court in legal cases and be able to explain to a lay audience, essentially a jury, what the trauma is to the body. So I get called in legal cases to testify on behalf of prosecutors and defense attorneys. That's in criminal cases. And also I get called on in civil cases to explain to the public and the jury what happened. Why did this person die? And also give them an understanding of ballistics, trajectory analysis in gunshot wound cases, and also survival interval. Could a person have survived and could they have conscious pain and suffering? And I'm not the only expert on this subject. Surgeons and neurologists and other experts in the medical profession get called upon by the legal system to explain gun violence in a legal setting. So that's why I found the whole idea of stay in your lane so offensive, because nobody is an expert on a gun just because they happen to go and purchase and buy a gun. People become experts on guns when they study weapons, when they fire them, and when they understand what terminal ballistic is, meaning what do the bullets do to people's bodies. We're the ones, doctors are the ones, who get called to court to testify in these cases because of our expertise. nobody can tell us that this isn't our lane.
Yes, well said. And I'm curious too a little bit about your background. You're a forensic pathologist, and I think of course famously the show Quincy MD from the 1970s, but of course even now in more recent times, and I know you've written about this, the television program CSI, and you've, as I said, you've written about this. So tell us, I guess, what are some of the major differences between what your real life is like and what gets shown in these television programs or movies?
I've got to give a shout out to CSI and other forensic shows like Forensic Files, because I do have to say they have spurred people's interest in the field, and they have brought a lot of students into medicine and into studying forensics. I'm inspired by that alone. The problem is that there is a consequence called the CSI effect, which is when the public thinks that science is a certain way because that's how they showed it on television. And that's not exactly what it's like. So the most typical thing that we get is the assumption that we can get DNA within 24, 48 hours, something like that we can get instantaneous results, when most laboratory turnaround times are on the order of several weeks. So that built-in delay causes frustration to the family members of those who have died because they don't understand why it's taking so long. And they think that we are somehow obstructing or that we're incompetent because we don't have the results right away like they have it on TV. That frustrates people in my field. On the lighter note, the thing that drives me crazy the most when I watch the shows is that they're always in the dark and they're going around with their little flashlights pointing at things. And every time I go to a crime scene when it's dark, we pull out the lights. The police have Klieg lights, and in somebody's house, we, you know, use our gloves and turn on the lights so we can see what we're doing. We don't just poke around with flashlights. So we need to be able to see the evidence, and that is just from an aesthetic point, one thing that drives me crazy about those shows.
Is that just a convention from like whodunits and detective stories? Like, why wouldn't they turn the lights on? It seems kind of silly.
It is, and the other aspects that drive me crazy are just the high-tech stuff, because we're still underfunded compared to most government agencies. A lot of, if you follow the news on these subjects, which I do, I actually have Google alerts for forensic pathologist and medical examiner, and you'll see alerts coming up through all over the country of medical examiner's office looking for more funding, coroner's office can't find forensic pathologists. So we really have a crisis that's brewing within my profession because not enough people are going into it, and there isn't enough government funding going to local coroners and medical examiners to investigate deaths and make sure that they can do their jobs with all the equipment that they need.
Well, one thing I will ask you is the requisite question is, did you always know you wanted to be a pathologist or a forensic pathologist at that? I mean, what led you down this pathway?
What led me down this path actually was my father. My father was a doctor. He was a psychiatrist, actually. And he committed suicide when I was 13 years old. And he was my world. I looked up to him. I wanted to be a doctor just like him. So I went to medical school, but without any clear idea of what specialty I wanted to practice. Like most physicians, I did my rotations in second and third year medical school to try to see what I wanted to go into. And I actually initially went into surgery. I did a general surgery rotation for about 6 months in Boston. And within that time period, I realized that it wasn't for me. The hours were too exhausting. Most of this was actually covered in working stiff. And I switched to pathology because I like the research, I like the quiet pace, I like the fact in particular that you have to be an expert on everything to be a pathologist, because especially in forensic pathology, children die, so you need to know pediatrics, pregnant women die, you need to know OBGYN, post-surgical patients die, you need to know about surgery, obviously trauma, infectious disease, toxicology. It's very exciting field for someone who constantly wants to learn things.
When you are asked by law enforcement to try to figure out the cause of death when it's not readily apparent, I mean, are you able to or required to do an assessment that involves every sort of modality that you just mentioned? I mean, including obviously toxicology, but infectious diseases, and bring to bear all those other specialties into what you do? Or do you sort of go down a pathway based on certain hunches or certain clues? Or is it just too hard to say and depend on each case?
It's just like any other aspect of medicine. We have to do history and physical. And so just like in a hospital setting where you'd sit down with a patient and ask them questions, well, we can't do that. Our patient is dead. But we can ask questions of their loved ones, the person who last saw them alive, any witnesses, and we can ask questions of their medical records. We can go through their chart. Even before we start the autopsy, we usually get at least a portion of their medical records. So it gives us the history. It gives us the clinical history to be able to develop a differential diagnosis, a list of things that potentially could be wrong, and that helps guide our autopsy. So in cases where I have someone who's been coughing and showing symptoms of an upper respiratory infection, and then I find out that they traveled recently, I'm going to be doing a much more infection-centered workup than I would be if the story was he's got a seizure disorder and he's been otherwise healthy, or he was shot in the street. I mean, I'm going to my workup and my technique when performing the autopsy is going to be different contingent on what information I get up front.
Dr. Melnick, you were brave enough to mention, and in fact have written about, very movingly, about your father's suicide, and just want to offer my sympathy. I also, too, am a suicide survivor. Tell us a little bit about how his suicide has impacted you. You mentioned that he was a physician, a psychiatrist, and that his being in medicine was something that guided you into the field, not necessarily knowing where you were going to go, but you've been pretty outspoken about the danger of suicide and being very public with this, because suicide, unfortunately, still very much lives in the shadows and is something that stigmatizes many of us, and it's hard for, obviously, many people to talk about. How did you decide that you were ready to share very publicly about your father's suicide?
I remember it actually quite clearly in my youth when family members would lie about my father's death and talk about it being a heart attack, mostly to protect the older generation because they were afraid that it would upset them and they were afraid of religious prohibitions against suicide. So that was considered a stigma that was based and steeped in the religion. I am of the belief that when we hide things, when we don't talk about them, that is much more common for them to occur, that by hiding them, we are making the situation worse. And the example I like to give is to compare it to the early years of the AIDS movement, when HIV was first starting to disseminate and the government wasn't doing anything about it. The activism was steeped in posters that said silence equals death. And I feel that the same thing applies to suicide. When I go and I speak about suicide, frequently I will stand in front of an audience and ask, how many of you know somebody who has either committed suicide or has threatened suicide? And pretty much universally, almost all the hands go up. And yet we don't talk about this. I really think that if we started talking more openly about suicide and what the risks are and what are interventions that we can do to step in and save a life, we can really make a change in the overall numbers, because of all the deaths that are out there, suicide is probably the most easily preventable when we look at epidemiological data. There have been many studies that have shown that, for example, in towns where there's a bridge where it's easy to jump over, as soon as they put up a barrier, not just the bridge suicides go down, the overall suicide rate goes down. When access is more difficult, then people find and reach out for help. They don't find other means. There's some kind of assumption in the public that once you attempt suicide, you are going to find some other way. So by taking away your gun or by making the bridge less accessible, you're just going to go kill yourself in some other way. And that's actually not true. The actual rate goes down. A lot of suicides, in my experience as a forensic pathologist, are actually impulsive acts. The person is despondent. They see the easy way out, and they jump on it because of the accessibility. So if we shut down the accessibility, we can actually thwart the suicide.
Now, it sort of brings us back to where we started the conversation, talking about gun violence and about physicians' role in that. And certainly physicians have a big role to play in suicide prevention and education, as you have alluded to. One thing I think I want to share with our listeners is that guns are not the leading tool used in suicide, but they are the most lethal.
Correct.
And so I was wondering if you could kind of clarify some of those statistics for us.
Yes. When it comes to the suicides that I'm aware of, guns are more lethal because people tend to use them by shooting themselves in the head. And that's what I see most frequently, is gunshot wounds to the head. when it comes to other modalities of suicide, it's much more difficult for a person to die instantaneously with them, and that's where family members or friends and physicians can intervene.
In the column that you wrote on MedPage Today about your father's suicide, which, again, was, I think, just so brave to put it out there, you mentioned, quite honestly, that sometimes you had thought of suicide, too, I think, during your education or when you were feeling down. And I think I'm glad to say that's, you know, certainly not where you are now. But I think that for all of us who are suicide survivors, we're left with not only that stigma and that shame, where you mentioned that relatives of yours would hide that. In my own mother's case, her obituary mentioned dying of natural causes, which wasn't true at age 60. But there seems to be a great deal of burnout and depression going on in the medical profession now, and I'm seeing a lot more written about this, as I think physicians have become frequently more harried in terms of seeing more patients and more documentation requirements. I mean, do you have a sense of that in terms of where you're working, where you're seeing lots of physician colleagues struggling with the profession and with their mood?
We in the medical profession have really been under a lot of stresses throughout. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're drawn to it to some degree. I mean, I think all of us are drawn to medicine, not just because we want to help people, but on some level because we like the challenges of a high-stress profession. I know some physicians even refer to themselves as adrenaline junkies, especially in emergency room medicine. That said, the stresses can take their toll long-term, and the profession is not very good at taking care of its own with regards to substance abuse or depression. When these start to interfere in a person's capacity to do their job, a lot of professions will just fire them, cut them off, or potentially report them to the medical board, in which case they lose not only their livelihood, but any ability to rehabilitate themselves. And so there's a lot of fear among medical professionals with regards to reaching out for help when they're despondent or when they are addicted. I would like to see some changes within our own profession to allow more time off, to allow more opportunities for people to have rehabilitation or support when they're going through a mental health crisis. I don't think these supports are currently in place. In a lot of specialties, you're just supposed to tough it out. And there are many people who either quit their specialty entirely, leave medicine entirely, or end up committing suicide, unfortunately. So we need to find a way to change the culture to make it more acceptable to talk about suicide, to talk about depression, and to create support systems, especially within residency, because that tends to be a real pressure cooker. So that students can have support, trainees can have support without feeling that they're going to lose their job or they're going to fail or they won't be able to support themselves ever again.
Dr. Judy Milinick is a forensic pathologist based in the Bay Area and also a research associate at the University of California, Davis. She and her husband, T.J. Mitchell, are co-authors of Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. And Dr. Judy Milinick, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for your efforts in telling the world that this is indeed our lane.
And thank you for spreading the word. I think it's really important when we do that, when we reach out to people and get them to come together on this.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.